creature with the ability to make up its own mind. All the other creatures were fully programmed robots. This book was in the form of a long letter from the creator of the universe to the experimental creature. The creator congratulated the creature and apologized for all the discomfort he had endured. The creator invited him to a banquet in his honor in the Empire Room of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City, where a black robot named Sammy Davis Jr. would sing and dance. And the experimental creature wasn't killed after the banquet. He was transferred to a virgin planet instead. Living cells were sliced from the palms of his hands while he was unconscious. The operation didn't hurt at all. And then the cells were stirred into a soupy sea on the virgin planet. They would evolve into ever more complicated life forms as the eons went by. Whatever shapes they assumed, they would have free will. Trout didn't give the experimental creature a proper name. He simply called him the Man. On the virgin planet, the man was Adam, and the sea was Eve. The man often sauntered by the sea. Sometimes he waded in his Eve. Sometimes he swam in her, but she was too soupy for an invigorating swim. She made her Adam feel sleepy and sticky afterwards, so he would dive into an icy stream that had just jumped off a mountain. He screamed when he dived into the icy water, screamed again when he came up for air. He bloodied his shins and laughed about it when he scrambled up rocks to get out of the water. He panted and laughed some more, and he thought of something amazing to yell. The creator never knew what he was going to yell, since the creator had no control over him. The man himself got to decide what he was going to do next and why. After a dip one day, for instance, the man yelled this, "Cheese!" Another time he yelled, "Wouldn't you really rather drive a Buick?" The only other big animal on the virgin planet was an angel who visited the man occasionally. He was a messenger and an investigator for the creator of the universe. He took the form of an 800-pound male cinnamon bear. He was a robot, too, and so was the creator, according to Kilgore Trout. The bear was attempting to get a line on why the man did what he did. He would ask, for instance, "Why did you yell cheese?" And the man would tell him mockingly, "Because I felt like it, you stupid machine." Here is what the man's tombstone on the virgin planet looked like at the end of the book by Kilgore Trout. "Not even the creator of the universe knew what the man was going to say next. Perhaps the man was a better universe in its infancy." R.I.P. 17. Bunny Hoover, Duane's homosexual son, was dressing for work now. He was the piano player in the cocktail lounge of the new Holiday Inn. He was poor. He lived alone in a room without a bath in the old Fairchild Hotel, which used to be fashionable. It was a flop house now, in the most dangerous part of Midland City. Very soon, Bunny Hoover would be seriously injured by Duane, would soon share an ambulance with Kilgore Trout. Bunny was pale, the same unhealthy color of the blind fish that used to live in the bowels of Sacred Miracle Cave. Those fish were extinct. They had all turned belly up years ago, had been flushed from the cave and into the Ohio River to turn belly up, to go bang in the noonday sun. Bunny avoided the sunshine, too, and the water from the taps of Midland City was becoming more poisonous every day. He ate very little. He prepared his own food in his room. The preparation was simple, since vegetables and fruits were all he ate, and he munched them raw. He not only did without dead meat, he did without living meat, too, without friends or lovers or pets. He had once been highly popular. When he was at Prairie Military Academy, for instance, the student body was unanimous in electing him cadet colonel, the highest rank possible, in his senior year. When Bunny played the piano bar at the Holiday Inn, he had many, many secrets. One of them was this. He wasn't really there. He was able to absent himself from the cocktail lounge and from the planet itself, for that matter, by means of transcendental meditation. He learned this technique from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who once stopped off in Midland City during a worldwide lecture tour. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, in exchange for a new handkerchief, a piece of fruit, a bunch of flowers, and $35, taught Bunny to close his eyes and to say this euphonious nonsense word to himself over and over again. "I-im, I-im, I-im." Bunny sat on the edge of his bed in the hotel room now, and he did it. "I-im, I-im," he said to himself internally. The rhythm of the chant matched one syllable with each two beats in his heart. He closed his eyes. He became a skin diver in the depths of his mind. The depths were seldom used. His heart slowed, his respiration nearly stopped. A single word floated by in the depths. It had somehow escaped from the busier parts of his mind. It wasn't connected to anything. It floated by, lazily, a translucent scarf-like fish. The word was untroubling. Here was the word. Blue. And then another lovely scarf swam by. It said, Claire de Lune. 15 minutes later, Bunny's awareness bobbed to the surface of its own accord. Bunny was refreshed. He got up from the bed, and he brushed his hair with the military brushes his mother had given him when he was elected cadet colonel so long ago. Bunny was sent away to military school, an institution devoted to homicide and absolutely humorless obedience, when he was only 10 years old. Here is why. He told Duane that he wished he were a woman instead of a man, because what men did was so often cruel and ugly. Listen. Bunny Hoover went to Prairie Military Academy for 8 years of uninterrupted sports, buggery, and fascism. Buggery consisted of sticking one's penis in someone else's asshole or mouth, or having it done to one by somebody else. Fascism was a fairly popular political philosophy, which made sacred whatever nation and race the philosopher happened to belong to. It called for an autocratic, centralized government headed up by a dictator. The dictator had to be obeyed, no matter what he told somebody to do. And Bunny would bring new medals with him every time he came home for vacation. He could fence and box and wrestle and swim. He could shoot a rifle and a pistol, fight with bayonets, ride a horse, creep and crawl through shrubbery, peek around corners without being seen. He would show off his medals, and his mother would tell him when his father was out of hearing that she was becoming unhappier with each passing day. She would hint that Duane was a monster. It wasn't true. It was all in her head. She would begin to tell Bunny what was so vile about Duane, but she always stopped short. You're too young to hear about such things, she'd say, even when Bunny was 16 years old. There's nothing you or anybody could do about them anyway. She would pretend to lock her lips with a key and then whisper to Bunny, There are secrets I will carry to my grave. Her biggest secret, of course, was one that Bunny didn't detect until she knocked herself off with Drano. Celia Hoover was crazy as a bedbug. My mother was, too. Listen. Bunny's mother and my mother were different sorts of human beings, but they were both beautiful in exotic ways, and they both boiled over with chaotic talk about love and peace and wars and evil and desperation, of better days coming by and by, of worse days coming by and by. And both our mothers committed suicide. Bunny's mother ate Drano. My mother ate sleeping pills, which wasn't nearly as horrible. And Bunny's mother and my mother had one really bizarre symptom in common. Neither one could stand to have her picture taken. They were usually fine in the daytime. They usually concealed their frenzies until late at night. But if somebody aimed a camera at either one of them during the daytime, the mother who was aimed at would crash down on her knees and protect her head with her arms, as though somebody was about to club her to death. It was a scary and pitiful thing to see. At least Bunny's mother taught him how to control a piano, which was a music machine. At least Bunny Hoover's mother taught him a trade. A good piano controller could get a job making music in cocktail lounges almost anywhere in the world, and Bunny was a good one. His military training was useless, despite all the medals he won. The armed forces knew he was a homosexual, that he was certain to fall in love with other fighting men, and the armed forces didn't want to put up with such love affairs. So Bunny Hoover now got ready to practice his trade. He slipped a black velvet dinner jacket over a black turtleneck sweater now. Bunny looked out his only window in the alleyway. The better rooms afforded views of Fairchild Park, where there had been 56 murders in the past 2 years. Bunny's room was on the second floor, so his window framed a piece of the blank brick side of what used to be the Kietzler Opera House. There was an historical marker on the front of the former opera house. Not many people could understand it, but this is what it said. Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, sang here August 11th, Anno Domini, MDCCLXXXI. The opera house used to be the home of the Midland City Symphony Orchestra, which was an amateur group of music enthusiasts. But they became homeless in 1927 when the opera house became a motion picture house, the Bannister. The orchestra remained homeless, too, until the Mildred Barrier Memorial Center for the Arts went up. And the Bannister was the city's leading movie house for many years until it was engulfed by the high crime district, which was moving north all the time. So it wasn't a theater anymore, even though there were still busts of Shakespeare and Mozart, and so on, gazing down from niches in the walls inside. The stage was still in there, too, but it was crowded with dinette sets now. The Empire Furniture Company had taken over the premises now. It was gangster-controlled. The nickname for Bunny's neighborhood was Skid Row. Every American town of any size had a neighborhood with the same nickname, Skid Row. It was a place where people who didn't have any friends or relatives or property or usefulness or ambition were supposed to go. People like that would be treated with disgust in other neighborhoods, and policemen would keep them moving. They were as easy to move, usually, as toy balloons. And they would drift hither and yon like balloons filled with some gas slightly heavier than air until they came to rest in Skid Row against the foundations of the old Fairchild Hotel. They could snooze and mumble to each other all day long. They could beg. They could get drunk. The basic scheme was this one. They were to stay there and not bother anybody anywhere else until they were murdered for thrills or until they were frozen to death by the wintertime. Kilgore Trout wrote a story one time about a town which decided to tell derelicts where they were and what was about to happen to them by putting up actual street signs that said, Skid Row. Bunny now smiled at himself in the mirror, in the leak. He called himself to attention for a moment, became again the insufferably brainless, humorless, heartless soldier he had learned to be in military school. He murmured the motto of the school, a motto he used to have to shout about 100 times a day, at dawn, at meals, at the start of every class, at games, at bayonet practice, at sunset, at bedtime. Can do, he said. Can do. 18. The Galaxy, in which Kilgore Trout was a passenger, was on the interstate now, close to Midland City. It was creeping. It was trapped in rush hour traffic from Barrytron and Western Electric and Prairie Mutual. Trout looked up from his reading, saw a billboard which said this, Turn back, you have just passed Sacred Miracle Cave. So Sacred Miracle Cave had become part of the past. As an old, old man, Trout would be asked by Dr. Thor Lembrig, the Secretary General of the United Nations, if he feared the future. He would give this reply, Mr. Secretary General, it is the past which scares the bejesus out of me. Dwayne Hoover was only 4 miles away. He was sitting alone on a zebra-skin banquette in the cocktail lounge of the new Holiday Inn. It was dark in there and quiet, too. The glare and uproar of rush hour traffic on the interstate was blocked out by the thick drapes of crimson velvet. On each table was a hurricane lamp with a candle inside, although the air was still. On each table was a bowl of dry, roasted peanuts, too, and a sign which allowed the staff to refuse service to anyone who was inharmonious with the mood of the lounge. Here is what it said. This table reserved. Bunny Hoover was controlling the piano. He had not looked up when his father came in. Neither had his father glanced in his direction. They had not exchanged greetings for many years. Bunny went on playing his white man's blues. They were slow and tinkling, with capricious silences here and there. Bunny's blues had some of the qualities of a music box, a tired music box. They tinkled, stopped, then reluctantly, torpidly, they managed a few tinkles more. Bunny's mother used to collect tinkling music boxes, among other things. Listen. Francine Pefko was at Duane's automobile agency next door. She was catching up on all the work she should have done that afternoon. Duane would beat her up very soon. And the only other person on the property with her as she typed and filed was Wayne Hubler, the black parolee, who still lurked among the used cars. Duane would try to beat him up, too, but Wayne was a genius at dodging blows. Francine was pure machinery at the moment, a machine made of meat, a typing machine, a filing machine. Wayne Hubler, on the other hand, had nothing machine-like to do. He ached to be a useful machine. The used cars were all locked up tight for the night. Now and then, aluminum propellers on a wire overhead would be turned by a lazy breeze, and Wayne would respond to them as best he could. Go, he would say to them. Spin round. He established a sort of relationship with the traffic on the interstate, too, appreciating its changing moods. Everybody going home, he said during the rush hour jam. Everybody home now, he said later on when the traffic thinned out. Now the sun was going down. Sun going down, said Wayne Hubler. He had no clues as to where to go next. He supposed, without minding much, that he might die of exposure that night. He had never seen death by exposure, had never been threatened by it, since he had so seldom been out of doors. He knew of death by exposure because the papery voice of the little radio in his cell told of people's dying of exposure from time to time. He missed that papery voice. He missed the clash of steel doors. He missed the bread and the stew and the pitchers of milk and coffee. He missed fucking other men in the mouth and the asshole, and being fucked in the mouth and the asshole, and jerking off, and fucking cows in the prison dairy. All events in a normal sex life on the planet, as far as he knew. Here would be a good tombstone for Wayne Hubler when he died. Black jailbird. He adapted to what there was to adapt to. The dairy at the prison provided milk and cream and butter and cheese and ice cream not only for the prison and the county hospital. It sold its products to the outside world, too. Its trademark didn't mention prison. This was it. Queen of the Prairies. Wayne couldn't read very well. The words Hawaii and Hawaiian, for instance, appeared in combination with more familiar words and symbols and signs painted on the windows of the showroom and on the windshields of some used cars. Wayne tried to decode the mysterious words phonetically without any satisfaction. Wahio, he would say, and Hu-hi-wu-hi, and so on. Wayne Hubler smiled now, not because he was happy, but because, with so little to do, he thought he might as well show off his teeth. They were excellent teeth. The adult correctional institution at Shepherdstown was proud of its dentistry program. It was such a famous dental program, in fact, that it had been written up in medical journals and in the Reader's Digest, which was the Dying Planet's most popular magazine. The theory behind the program was that many ex-convicts could not or would not get jobs because of their appearances, and good looks began with good teeth. The program was so famous, in fact, that police, even in neighboring states, when they picked up a poor man with expensively maintained teeth, fillings, and bridge work, and all that, were likely to ask him, "All right, boy, how many years you spend in Shepherdstown?" Wayne Hubler heard some of the orders which a waitress called to the bartender in the cocktail lounge. Wayne heard her call, "Gilby's and quinine with a twist." He had no idea what that was, or a Manhattan, or a Brandy Alexander, or a slow gin fizz. "Give me a Johnny Walker Rob Roy," she called, "and a Southern Comfort on the rocks, and a Bloody Mary with Wolfschmitz." Wayne's only experiences with alcohol had to do with drinking cleaning fluids and eating shoe polish and so on. He had no fondness for alcohol. "Give me a black and white and water," he heard the waitress say, and Wayne should have pricked up his ears at that. That particular drink wasn't for an ordinary person. That drink was for the person who had created all Wayne's misery to date, who could kill him or make him a millionaire or send him back to prison or do whatever he damn pleased with Wayne. That drink was for me. I had come to the arts festival incognito. I was there to watch a confrontation between two human beings I had created, Dwayne Hoover and Kilgore Trout. I was not eager to be recognized. The waitress lit the hurricane lamp on my table. I pinched out the flame with my fingers. I had bought a pair of sunglasses at a Holiday Inn outside of Ashtabula, Ohio, where I spent the night before. I wore them in the darkness now. The lenses were silvered, were mirrors to anyone looking my way. Anyone wanting to know what my eyes were like was confronted with his or her own twin reflections. Where other people in the cocktail lounge had eyes, I had two holes into another universe. I had leaks. There was a book of matches on my table, next to my pell-mell cigarettes. Here is the message on the book of matches, which I read an hour and a half later, while Dwayne was beating the daylights out of Francine Pefko. "It's easy to make $100 a week in your spare time by showing comfortable, latest-style Mason shoes to your friends. Everybody goes for Mason shoes with their many special comfort features. We'll send free money-making kits so you can run your business from home. We'll even tell you how you can earn shoes free of cost as a bonus for taking profitable orders." And so on. "This is a very bad book you're writing," I said to myself behind my leaks. "I know," I said. "You're afraid you'll kill yourself the way your mother did," I said. "I know," I said. There in the cocktail lounge, peering out through my leaks at a world of my own invention, I mouthed this word, schizophrenia. The sound and appearance of the word had fascinated me for many years. It sounded and looked to me like a human being sneezing in a blizzard of soap flakes. I did not and do not know for certain that I have that disease. This much I knew and know. I was making myself hideously uncomfortable by not narrowing my attention to details of life which were immediately important, and by refusing to believe what my neighbors believed. I am better now. Word of honor. I am better now. I was really sick for a while, though. I sat there in a cocktail lounge of my own invention, and I stared through my leaks at a white cocktail waitress of my own invention. I named her Bonnie McMahon. I had her bring Dwayne Hoover his customary drink, which was a House of Lords martini with a twist of lemon peel. She was a longtime acquaintance of Dwayne's. Her husband was a guard in the sexual offenders wing of the adult correctional institution. Bonnie had to work as a waitress because her husband lost all their money by investing it in a car wash in Shepherdstown. Dwayne had advised them not to do it. Here's how Dwayne knew her and her husband, Ralph. They had bought 9 Pontiacs from him over the past 16 years. "We're a Pontiac family," they'd say. Bonnie made a joke now as she served him his martini. She made the same joke every time she served anybody a martini. "Breakfast of champions," she said. The expression, "breakfast of champions," is a registered trademark of General Mills, Inc., for use on a breakfast cereal product. The use of the identical expression as the title for this book, as well as throughout the book, is not intended to indicate an association with or sponsorship by General Mills, nor is it intended to disparage their fine products. Dwayne was hoping that some of the distinguished visitors to the arts festival, who were all staying at the inn, would come into the cocktail lounge. He wanted to talk to them, if he could, to discover whether they had truths about life which he had never heard before. Here is what he hoped new truths might do for him: enable him to laugh at his troubles, to go on living, and to keep out of the north wing of the Midland County General Hospital, which was for lunatics. While he waited for an artist to appear, he consoled himself with the only artistic creation of any depth and mystery which was stored in his head. It was a poem he had been forced to learn by heart during his sophomore year in Sugar Creek High School, the elite white high school at the time. Sugar Creek High was a nigger high school now. Here was the poem. "The moving finger writes, and, having writ, moves on. Nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line. Nor all your tears wash out a word of it." Some poem. And Dwayne was so open to new suggestions about the meaning of life that he was easily hypnotized. So when he looked down into his martini, he was put into a trance by dancing myriads of winking eyes on the surface of his drink. The eyes were beads of lemon oil. Dwayne missed it when 2 distinguished visitors to the arts festival came in and sat down on bar stools next to Bunny's piano. They were white. They were Beatrice Kiedsler, the Gothic novelist, and Rabo Karabekian, the minimal painter. Bunny's piano, a Steinway Baby Grand, was armored with pumpkin-colored formica and ringed with stools. People could eat and drink from the piano. On the previous Thanksgiving, a family of 11 had had Thanksgiving dinner served on the piano. Bunny played. "This has to be the asshole of the universe," said Rabo Karabekian, the minimal painter. Beatrice Kiedsler, the Gothic novelist, had grown up in Midland City. "I was petrified about coming home after all these years," she said to Karabekian. "Americans are always afraid of coming home," said Karabekian. "With good reason, may I say." "They used to have good reason," said Beatrice, "but not anymore. The past has been rendered harmless. I would tell any wandering American now, of course you can go home again, and as often as you please. It's just a motel." Traffic on the westbound barrel of the interstate had come to a halt a mile east of the new Holiday Inn because of a fatal accident on exit 10A. Drivers and passengers got out of their cars to stretch their legs and find out, if they could, what the trouble was up ahead. Kilgore Trout was among those who got out. He learned from others that the new Holiday Inn was within easy walking distance. So he gathered up his parcels from the front seat of the Galaxy, he thanked the driver, whose name he had forgotten, and he began to trudge. He also began to assemble in his mind a system of beliefs which would be appropriate to his narrow mission in Midland City, which was to show provincials who were bent on exalting creativity a would-be creator who had failed and failed. He paused in his trudge to examine himself in the rearview mirror, the rearview leak, of a truck locked up in traffic. The tractor was pulling 2 trailers instead of 1. Here was the message the owners of the rig saw fit to shriek at human beings wherever it went. Peerless. Trout's image in the leak was as shocking as he had hoped it would be. He had not washed up after his drubbing by the Pluto gang, so there was caked blood on 1 earlobe and more under his left nostril. There was dog shit on a shoulder of his coat. He had collapsed into dog shit on the handball court under the Queensboro Bridge after the robbery. By an unbelievable coincidence, that shit came from the wretched greyhound belonging to a girl I knew. The girl with the greyhound was an assistant lighting director for a musical comedy about American history, and she kept her poor greyhound, who was named Lancer, in a one-room apartment 14 feet wide and 26 feet long, and 6 flights of stairs above street level. His entire life was devoted to unloading his excrement at the proper time and place. There were 2 proper places to put it: in the gutter outside the door 72 steps below, with the traffic whizzing by, or in a roasting pan his mistress kept in front of the Westinghouse refrigerator. Lancer had a very small brain, but he must have suspected from time to time, just as Wayne Hubler did, that some kind of terrible mistake had been made. Trout trudged onward, a stranger in a strange land. His pilgrimage was rewarded with new wisdom, which would never have been his had he remained in his basement in Coho's. He learned the answer to a question many human beings were asking themselves so frantically. What's blocking traffic on the westbound barrel of the Midland City stretch of the interstate? The scales fell from the eyes of Kilgore Trout. He saw the explanation. A Queen of the Prairies milk truck was lying on its side, blocking the flow. It had been hit hard by a ferocious Chevrolet Caprice 2-door. The Chevy had jumped the median divider strip. The Chevy's passenger hadn't used his seatbelt. He had shot right through the shatterproof windshield. He was lying dead now in the concrete trough containing Sugar Creek. The Chevy's driver was also dead. He had been skewered by the post of his steering wheel. The Chevy's passenger was bleeding blood as he lay dead in Sugar Creek. The milk truck was bleeding milk. Milk and blood were about to be added to the composition of the stinking ping-pong balls which were being manufactured in the bowels of Sacred Miracle Cave. 19. I was on a par with the creator of the universe, there in the dark in the cocktail lounge. I shrunk the universe to a ball exactly 1 light year in diameter. I had it explode. I had it disperse itself again. Ask me a question, any question. How old is the universe? It is 1/2 second old, but that half second has lasted 1 quintillion years so far. Who created it? Nobody created it. It has always been here. What is time? It is a serpent which eats its tail. This is the snake which uncoiled itself long enough to offer Eve the apple. What was the apple which Eve and Adam ate? It was the creator of the universe. And so on. Symbols can be so beautiful, sometimes. Listen. The waitress brought me another drink. She wanted to light my hurricane lamp again. I wouldn't let her. Can you see anything in the dark with your sunglasses on? She asked me. The big show is inside my head, I said. Oh, she said. I can tell fortunes, I said. You want your fortune told? Not right now, she said. She went back to the bar, and she and the bartender had some sort of conversation about me, I think. The bartender took several anxious looks in my direction. All he could see were the leaks over my eyes. I did not worry about his asking me to leave the establishment. I had created him, after all. I gave him a name, Harold Newcomb Wilbur. I awarded him the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Soldier's Medal, the Good Conduct Medal, and a purple heart with 2 oak leaf clusters, which made him the 2nd most decorated veteran in Midland City. I put all his medals under his handkerchiefs in a dresser drawer. He won all those medals in the 2nd World War, which was staged by robots so that Dwayne Hoover could give a free-willed reaction to such a holocaust. The war was such an extravaganza that there was scarcely a robot anywhere who didn't have a part to play. Harold Newcomb Wilbur got his medals for killing Japanese, who were yellow robots. They were fueled by rice. And he went on staring at me, even though I wanted to stop him now. Here was the thing about my control over the characters I created. I could only guide their movements approximately, since they were such big animals. There was inertia to overcome. It wasn't as though I was connected to them by steel wires. It was more as though I was connected to them by stale rubber bands. So I made the green telephone in the back of the bar ring. Harold Newcomb Wilbur answered it, but he kept his eyes on me. I had to think fast about who was on the other end of the telephone. I put the most decorated veteran in Midland City on the other end. He had a penis 800 miles long and 210 miles in diameter, but practically all of it was in the 4th dimension. He got his medals in the war in Vietnam. He also had fought yellow robots who ran on rice. Cocktail lounge, said Harold Newcomb Wilbur. Hal?
Yes?
This is Ned Lingamon. I'm busy. Don't hang up. The cops sat me down at city jail. They only let me have one call, so I called you. Why me? You're the only friend I've got left. What they got you in for? They say I killed my baby. And so on. This man, who was white, had all the medals Harold Newcomb Wilbur had, plus the highest decoration for heroism which an American soldier could receive. He had now also committed the lowest crime which an American could commit, which was to kill his own child. Her name was Cynthia Ann, and she certainly didn't live very long before she was made dead again. She got killed for crying and crying. She wouldn't shut up. First, she drove her 17-year-old mother away with all her demands, and then her father killed her. And so on. As for the fortune I might have told for the waitress, this was it. You will be swindled by termite exterminators and not even know it. You will buy steel-belted radial tires for the front wheels of your car. Your cat will be killed by a motorcyclist named Hedley Thomas, and you will get another cat. Arthur, your brother in Atlanta, will find $11 in a taxicab. I might have told Bunny Hoover's fortune, too. Your father will become extremely ill, and you will respond so grotesquely that there will be talk of putting you in the booby hatch, too. You will stage scenes in the hospital waiting room, telling doctors and nurses that you are to blame for your father's disease. You will blame yourself for trying for so many years to kill him with hatred. You will redirect your hatred. You will hate your mom. And so on. And I had Wayne Hubler, the black ex-convict, stand bleakly among the garbage cans outside the back door of the inn and examine the currency which had been given to him at the prison gate that morning. He had nothing else to do. He studied the pyramid with a blazing eye on top. He wished he had more information about the pyramid and the eye. There was so much to learn. Wayne didn't even know the earth revolved around the sun. He thought the sun revolved around the earth, because it certainly looked that way. A truck sizzled by on the interstate, seemed to cry out in pain to Wayne, because he read the message on the side of it phonetically. The message told Wayne that the truck was in agony, as it hauled things from here to there. This was the message, and Wayne said it out loud. Hurts. Here's what was going to happen to Wayne in about 4 days, because I wanted it to happen to him. He would be picked up and questioned by policemen because he was behaving suspiciously outside the back gate of Barrytron Limited, which was involved in super-secret weapons work. They thought at first that he might be pretending to be stupid and ignorant, that he might, in fact, be a cunning spy for the communists. A check of his fingerprints and his wonderful dental work proved that he was who he said he was. But there was still something else he had to explain. What was he doing with a membership card in the Playboy Club of America, made out in the name of Paolo Di Capistrano? He had found it in a garbage can in the back of the new Holiday Inn. And so on. And it was time now for me to have Rabbo Karabekian, the minimalist painter, and Beatrice Kiedsler, the novelist, say and do some more stuff for the sake of this book. I did not want to spook them by staring at them as I worked their control, so I pretended to be absorbed in drawing pictures on my tabletop with a damp fingertip. I drew the Earthling symbol for nothingness. I drew the Earthling symbol for everything. Dwayne Hoover and Wayne Hubler knew the first one, but not the second one. And now I drew a symbol in vanishing mist, which was bitterly familiar to Dwayne, but not to Wayne. This was it. Drano. And now I drew a symbol whose meaning Dwayne had known for a few years in school, a meaning which had since eluded him. The symbol would have looked like the end of a table in a prison dining hall to Wayne. It represented the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. This ratio could also be expressed as a number, and even as Dwayne and Wayne and Karabekian and Beatrice Kiedsler and all the rest of us went about our business, Earthling scientists were monotonously radioing that number into outer space. The idea was to show other inhabited planets, in case they were listening, how intelligent we were. We had tortured circles until they coughed up this symbol of their secret lives. And I made an invisible duplicate on my formica tabletop of a painting by Rabbo Karabekian entitled The Temptation of St. Anthony. My duplicate was a miniature of the real thing, and mine was not in color. But I had captured the picture's form and the spirit, too. The original was 20 feet wide and 16 feet high. The field was Hawaiian Avocado, a green wall paint manufactured by the O'Hare Paint and Varnish Company in Hellertown, Pennsylvania. The vertical stripe was Day Glow Orange Reflecting Tape. This was the most expensive piece of art, not counting buildings and tombstones, not counting the statue of Abraham Lincoln in front of the old nigger high school. It was a scandal what the painting cost. It was the first purchase for the permanent collection of the Mildred Barry Memorial Center for the Arts. Fred T. Barry, the chairman of the board of Barrytron Limited, had coughed up $50,000 of his own for the picture. Midland City was outraged. So was I. So was Beatrice Keedsler, but she kept her dismay to herself as she sat at the piano bar with Karabekian. Karabekian, who wore a sweatshirt imprinted with the likeness of Beethoven, knew he was surrounded by people who hated him for getting so much money for so little work. He was amused. Like everybody else in the cocktail lounge, he was softening his brain with alcohol. This was a substance produced by a tiny creature called yeast. Yeast organisms ate sugar and excreted alcohol. They killed themselves by destroying their own environment with yeast shit. Kilgore Trout once wrote a story, which was a dialogue between two pieces of yeast. They were discussing the possible purposes of life as they ate sugar and suffocated in their own excrement. Because of their limited intelligence, they never came close to guessing that they were making champagne. So I had Beatrice Keedsler say to Rabble Karabekian there at the piano bar, "This is a dreadful confession, but I don't even know who St. Anthony was. Who was he? And why should anybody have wanted to tempt him?"
"I don't know, and I would hate to find out," said Karabekian.
"You have no use for truth?" said Beatrice. "You know what truth is," said Karabekian. "It's some crazy thing my neighbor believes. If I want to make friends with him, I ask him what he believes, and he tells me, and I say, 'Yeah, yeah, ain't it the truth?'" I had no respect whatsoever for the creative works of either the painter or the novelist. I thought Karabekian, with his meaningless pictures, had entered into a conspiracy with millionaires to make poor people feel stupid. I thought Beatrice Keedsler had joined hands with other old-fashioned storytellers to make people believe that life had leading characters, minor characters, significant details, insignificant details, that it had lessons to be learned, tests to be passed, and a beginning, a middle, and an end. As I approached my 50th birthday, I had become more and more enraged and mystified by the idiot decisions made by my countrymen. And then I had come suddenly to pity them, for I understood how innocent and natural it was for them to behave so abominably, and with such abominable results. They were doing their best to live like people invented in storybooks. This was the reason Americans shot each other so often. It was a convenient literary device for ending short stories and books. Why were so many Americans treated by their government as though their lives were as disposable as paper facial tissues? Because that was the way authors customarily treated bit part players in their made-up tales. And so on. Once I understood what was making America such a dangerous, unhappy nation of people who had nothing to do with real life, I resolved to shun storytelling. I would write about life. Every person would be exactly as important as any other. All facts would also be given equal weightiness. Nothing would be left out. Let others bring order to chaos. I would bring chaos to order instead, which I think I have done. If all writers would do that, then perhaps citizens not in the literary trades will understand that there is no order in the world around us, that we must adapt ourselves to the requirements of chaos instead. It is hard to adapt to chaos, but it can be done. I am living proof of that. It can be done. Adapting to chaos there in the cocktail lounge, I now had Bonnie McMahon, who was exactly as important as anybody else in the universe, bring more yeast excrement to Beatrice Keedsler and Karabekian. Karabekian's drink was a beefeater's dry martini with a twist of lemon peel, so Bonnie said to him, "Breakfast of champions." "That's what you said when you brought me my first martini," said Karabekian. "I say it every time I give anybody a martini," said Bonnie. "Doesn't that get tiresome?" said Karabekian. "Or maybe that's why people found cities in godforsaken places like this, so they can make the same jokes over and over again until the bright angel of death stops their mouths with ashes." "I just try to cheer people up," said Bonnie. "If that's a crime, I never heard about it till now. I'll stop saying it from now on. I beg your pardon. I did not mean to give offense." Bonnie detested Karabekian, but she was as sweet as pie to him. She had a policy of never showing her anger about anything there in the cocktail lounge. The largest part of her income by far came from tips, and the way to get big tips was to smile, 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 no matter what. Bonnie had only two goals in life now. She meant to recoup all the money her husband had lost in the car wash in Shepherdstown, and she ached to have steel-belted radial tires for the front wheels of her automobile. Her husband, meanwhile, was at home watching professional golfers on television and getting smashed on yeast excrement. Saint Anthony, incidentally, was an Egyptian who founded the very first monastery, which was a place where men could live simple lives and pray often to the creator of the universe without the distractions of ambition and sex and yeast excrement. Saint Anthony himself sold everything he had when he was young, and he went out into the wilderness and lived alone for 20 years. He was often tempted during all those years of perfect solitude by visions of good times he might have had with food and men and women and children and the marketplace and so on. His biographer was another Egyptian, Saint Athanasius, whose theories on the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the divinity of the Holy Spirit, set down 300 years after the murder of Christ, were considered valid by Catholics, even in Dwayne Hoover's time. The Catholic high school in Midland City, in fact, was named in honor of Saint Athanasius. It was named in honor of Saint Christopher at first, but then the Pope, who was head of Catholic churches everywhere, announced that there probably had never been a Saint Christopher, so people shouldn't honor him anymore. A black male dishwasher stepped out of the kitchen of the inn now for a pell-mell cigarette and some fresh air. He wore a large button on his sweat-soaked white T-shirt, which said this, "Support the Arts." There were bowls of such buttons around the inn for anybody to help himself to, and the dishwasher had taken one in a spirit of levity. He had no use for works of art, except for cheap and simple ones, which weren't meant to live very long. His name was Eldon Robbins, and he had a penis 9 inches long and 2 inches in diameter. Eldon Robbins, too, had spent time in the adult correctional institution, so it was easy for him to recognize Wayne Hubler out among the garbage cans as a new parolee. "Welcome to the real world, brother," he said gently with wry lovingness to Wayne. "When was the last time you ate? This morning?" Wayne shyly acknowledged that this was true. So Eldon took him through a kitchen to a long table where the kitchen staff ate. There was a television set back there, and it was on, and it showed Wayne the beheading of Queen Mary of Scotland. Everybody was all dressed up, and Queen Mary put her head on the block of her own accord. Eldon arranged for Wayne to get a free steak and mashed potatoes and gravy and anything else he wanted, all prepared by other black men in the kitchen. There was a bowl of Arts Festival buttons on the table, and Eldon made Wayne put one on before he ate. "Wear this at all times," he told Wayne gravely, "and no harm can come to you." Eldon revealed to Wayne a peephole, which kitchen workers had drilled through the wall and into the cocktail lounge. "When you get tired of watching television," he said, "you can watch the animals in the zoo." Eldon himself had a look through the peephole, told Wayne that there was a man seated at the piano bar who had been paid $50,000 for sticking a piece of yellow tape to a green piece of canvas. He insisted that Wayne take a good look at Karabekian. Wayne obeyed. And Wayne wanted to remove his eye from the peephole after a few seconds because he didn't have nearly enough background information for any sort of understanding of what was going on in the cocktail lounge. The candles puzzled him, for instance. He supposed that the electricity in there had failed and that somebody had gone to change a fuse. Also, he didn't know what to make of Bonnie McMahon's costume, which consisted of white cowboy boots and black net stockings with crimson garters plainly showing across several inches of bare thigh and a tight sequin sort of bathing suit with a puff of pink cotton pinned to its rear. Bonnie's back was to Wayne, so he could not see that she wore octagonal rimless trifocals and was a horse-faced woman of 42 years old. He could not see either that she was smiling, 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 no matter how insulting Karabekian became. He could read Karabekian's lips, however. He was good at reading lips, as was anyone who had spent any time in Shepherdstown. The rule of silence was enforced in the corridors and at meals in Shepherdstown. Karabekian was saying this to Bonnie, indicating Beatrice Keedsler with a wave of his hand. "This distinguished lady is a famous storyteller and also a native of this railroad junction. Perhaps you could tell her some recent true stories about her birthplace." "I don't know any," said Bonnie. "Oh, come now," said Karabekian. "Every human being in this room must be worth a great novel." He pointed at Dwayne Hoover. "What is the life story of that man?" Bonnie limited herself to telling about Dwayne's dog, Sparky, who couldn't wag his tail. "So he has to fight all the time," she said. "Wonderful," said Karabekian. He turned to Beatrice. "I'm sure you can use that somewhere." "As a matter of fact, I can," said Beatrice. "That's an enchanting detail." "The more details, the better," said Karabekian. "Thank God for novelists. Thank God there are people willing to write everything down. Otherwise, so much would be forgotten." He begged Bonnie for more true stories. Bonnie was deceived by his enthusiasm and energized by the idea that Beatrice Kiezler honestly needed true stories for her books. "Well," she said, "would you consider Shepherdstown part of Midland City, more or less?"
"Of course," said Karabekian, who had never heard of Shepherdstown.
"What would Midland City be without Shepherdstown, and what would Shepherdstown be without Midland City?" "Well," said Bonnie, and she thought she had what was maybe a really good story to tell. "My husband is a guard at the Shepherdstown Adult Correctional Institution, and he used to have to keep people who were going to be electrocuted company, back when they used to electrocute people all the time. He'd play cards with them or read parts of the Bible out loud to them or whatever they wanted to do, and he had to keep a white man named Leroy Joyce company." Bonnie's costume gave off a faint, fishy, queer glow as she spoke. This was because her garments were heavily impregnated with fluorescent chemicals. So was the bartender's jacket. So were the African masks on the walls. The chemicals would shine like electric signs when ultraviolet lights in the ceiling were energized. The lights weren't on just now. The bartender turned them on at random times, at his own whim, in order to give the customers a delightful and mystifying surprise. The power for the lights and for everything electrical in Midland City, incidentally, was generated by coal from strip mines in West Virginia, through which Kilgore Trout had passed not many hours before. "Leroy Joyce was so dumb," Bonnie went on. "He couldn't play cards. He couldn't understand the Bible. He could hardly talk. He ate his last supper, and then he sat still. He was going to be electrocuted for rape. So my husband sat out in the corridor outside the cell, and he read to himself. He heard Leroy moving around in his cell, but he didn't worry about it. And then Leroy rattled his tin cup on the bars. My husband thought Leroy wanted some more coffee, so he got up and went over and took the cup. Leroy was smiling as though everything was all right now. He wouldn't have to go to the electric chair after all. He'd cut off his whatchamacallit and put it in the cup." This book is made up, of course, but the story I had Bonnie tell actually happened in real life. In the death house of a penitentiary in Arkansas. As for Dwayne Hoover's dog Sparky, who couldn't wag his tail, Sparky is modeled after a dog my brother owns who has to fight all the time because he can't wag his tail. There really is such a dog. Rabbo Karabekian asked Bonnie McMahon to tell him something about the teenage girl on the cover of the program for the Festival of the Arts. This was the only internationally famous human being in Midland City. She was Mary Alice Miller, the woman's 200-meter breaststroke champion of the world. She was only 15, said Bonnie. Mary Alice was also the queen of the Festival of the Arts. The cover of the program showed her in a white bathing suit, with her Olympic gold medal hanging around her neck. Mary Alice was smiling at a picture of St. Sebastian by the Spanish painter El Greco. It had been loaned to the festival by Elliot Rosewater, the patron of Kilgore Trout. St. Sebastian was a Roman soldier who had lived 1,700 years before me and Mary Alice Miller and Wayne and Dwayne and all the rest of us. He had secretly become a Christian when Christianity was against the law, and somebody squealed on him. The Emperor Diocletian had him shot by archers. The picture Mary Alice smiled at with such uncritical bliss showed a human being who was so full of arrows that he looked like a porcupine. Something almost nobody knew about St. Sebastian, incidentally, since painters like to put so many arrows into him, was that he survived the incident. He actually got well. He walked around Rome praising Christianity and bad-mouthing the emperor, so he was sentenced to death a second time. He was beaten to death by rods. And so on. And Bonnie McMahon told Beatrice and Karabekian that Mary Alice's father, who was a member of the parole board out at Shepherdstown, had taught Mary Alice to swim when she was 8 months old, and that he had made her swim at least 4 hours a day, every day, since she was three. Rabbo Karabekian thought this over, and then he said loudly so a lot of people could hear him, "What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor?" And now comes the spiritual climax of this book, for it is at this point that I, the author, am suddenly transformed by what I have done so far. This is why I had gone to Midland City, to be born again. And chaos announced that it was about to give birth to a new me by putting these words in the mouth of Rabbo Karabekian. What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor? Such a small remark was able to have such thundering consequences because the spiritual matrix of the cocktail lounge was in what I choose to call a pre-earthquake condition. Terrific forces were at work on our souls, but they could do no work because they balanced one another so nicely. But then a grain of sand crumbled. One force had a sudden advantage over another, and spiritual continents began to shrug and heave. One force, surely, was the lust for money, which infested so many people in the cocktail lounge. They knew what Rabbo Karabekian had been paid for his painting, And they wanted $50,000, too. They could have a lot of fun with $50,000, or so they believed, but they had to earn money the hard way, just a few dollars at a time instead. It wasn't right. Another force was the fear in these same people that their lives might be ridiculous, that their entire city might be ridiculous. Now the worst had happened. Mary Alice Miller, the one thing about their city which they had supposed was ridicule-proof, had just been lazily ridiculed by a man from out of town. And my own pre-earthquake condition must have been taken into consideration, too, since I was the one who was being reborn. Nobody else in the cocktail lounge was reborn, as far as I know. The rest got their minds changed, some of them, about the value of modern art. As for myself, I had come to the conclusion that there was nothing sacred about myself or about any human being, that we were all machines doomed to collide and collide and collide. For want of anything better to do, we became fans of collisions. Sometimes I wrote well about collisions, which meant I was a writing machine in good repair. Sometimes I wrote badly, which meant I was a writing machine in bad repair. I no more harbored sacredness than did a Pontiac, a mousetrap, or a South Bend lathe. I did not expect Rabbo Karabekian to rescue me. I had created him, and he was, in my opinion, a vain and weak and trashy man, no artist at all. But it is Rabbo Karabekian who made me the serene earthling which I am today. Listen. What kind of man would turn his daughter into an outboard motor? He said to Bonnie McMahon. Bonnie McMahon blew up. This was the first time she had blown up since she had come to work in the cocktail lounge. Her voice became as unpleasant as the noise of a bandsaw's cutting galvanized tin. It was loud, too. Oh, yeah? She said. Oh, yeah? Everybody froze. Bunny Hoover stopped playing the piano. Nobody wanted to miss a word. You don't think much of Mary Alice Miller? She said. Well, we don't think much of your painting. I've seen better pictures done by a 5-year-old. Karabekian slid off his bar stool so he could face all those enemies standing up. He certainly surprised me. I expected him to retreat in a hail of olives, maraschino cherries, and lemon rinds, but he was majestic up there. Listen, he said so calmly. I have read the editorial against my painting in your wonderful newspaper. I have read every word of the hate mail you have been thoughtful enough to send to New York. This embarrassed people some. The painting did not exist until I made it, Karabekian went on. Now that it does exist, nothing would make me happier than to have it reproduced again and again and vastly improved upon by all the 5-year-olds in town. I would love for your children to find pleasantly and playfully what it took me many angry years to find. I now give you my word of honor, he went on, that the picture your city owns shows everything about life which truly matters, with nothing left out. It is a picture of the awareness of every animal. It is the immaterial core of every animal, the I am to which all messages are sent. It is all that is alive in any of us, in a mouse, in a deer, in a cocktail waitress. It is unwavering and pure. No matter what preposterous adventure may befall us, a sacred picture of Saint Anthony alone is one vertical, unwavering band of light. If a cockroach were near him, or a cocktail waitress, the picture would show two such bands of light. Our awareness is all that is alive and may be sacred in any of us. Everything else about us is dead machinery. I have just heard from this cocktail waitress here, this vertical band of light, a story about her husband and an idiot who is about to be executed at Shepherdstown. Very well. Let a 5-year-old paint a sacred interpretation of that encounter. Let that 5-year-old strip away the idiocy, the bars, the waiting electric chair, the uniform of the guard, the gun of the guard, the bones and meat of the guard. What is that perfect picture which any 5-year-old can paint? Two unwavering bands of light. Ecstasy bloomed on the barbaric face of Rabbo Karabekian. Citizens of Midland City, I salute you, he said. You have given a home to a masterpiece. Dwayne Hoover, incidentally, wasn't taking any of this in. He was still hypnotized, turned inward. He was thinking about moving fingers, writing, and moving on, and so forth. He had bats in his bell tower. He was off his rocker. He wasn't playing with a full deck of cards. A black male dishwasher stepped out of the kitchen of the inn now for a pell-mell cigarette and some fresh air. He wore a large button on a sweat-soaked white T-shirt, which said this, "Support the Arts." There were bowls of such buttons around the inn for anybody to help himself to, and the dishwasher had taken one in a spirit of levity. He had no use for works of art, except for cheap and simple ones, which weren't meant to live very long. His name was Eldon Robbins, and he had a penis 9 inches long and 2 inches in diameter. Eldon Robbins, too, had spent time in the adult correctional institution, so it was easy for him to recognize Wayne Hubler out among the garbage cans as a new parolee. "Welcome to the real world, brother," he said gently with wry lovingness to Wayne. "When was the last time you ate? This morning?" Wayne shyly acknowledged that this was true. So Eldon took him through a kitchen to a long table where the kitchen staff ate. There was a television set back there, and it was on, and it showed Wayne the beheading of Queen Mary of Scotland. Everybody was all dressed up, and Queen Mary put her head on the block of her own accord. Eldon arranged for Wayne to get a free steak and mashed potatoes and gravy and anything else he wanted, all prepared by other black men in the kitchen. There was a bowl of Arts Festival buttons on the table, and Eldon made Wayne put one on before he ate. "Wear this at all times," he told Wayne gravely, "and no harm can come to you." Eldon revealed to Wayne a peephole, which kitchen workers had drilled through the wall and into the cocktail lounge. "When you get tired of watching television," he said, "you can watch the animals in the zoo." Eldon himself had a look through the peephole, told Wayne that there was a man seated at the piano bar who had been paid $50,000 for sticking a piece of yellow tape to a green piece of canvas. He insisted that Wayne take a good look at Karabekian. Wayne obeyed. And Wayne wanted to remove his eye from the peephole after a few seconds because he didn't have nearly enough background information for any sort of understanding of what was going on in the cocktail lounge. The candles puzzled him, for instance. He supposed that the electricity in there had failed and that somebody had gone to change a fuse. Also, he didn't know what to make of Bonnie McMahon's costume, which consisted of white cowboy boots and black net stockings with crimson garters plainly showing across several inches of bare thigh, and a tight sequin sort of bathing suit with a puff of pink cotton pinned to its rear. Bonnie's back was to Wayne, so he could not see that she wore octagonal, rimless trifocals and was a horse-faced woman of 42 years old. He could not see either that she was smiling, 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 no matter how insulting Karabekian became. He could read Karabekian's lips, however. He was good at reading lips, as was anyone who had spent any time in Shepherdstown. The rule of silence was enforced in the corridors and at meals in Shepherdstown. Karabekian was saying this to Bonnie, indicating Beatrice Keedsler with a wave of his hand. "This distinguished lady is a famous storyteller and also a native of this railroad junction. Perhaps you could tell her some recent true stories about her birthplace." "I don't know any," said Bonnie. "Oh, come now," said Karabekian. "Every human being in this room must be worth a great novel." He pointed at Dwayne Hoover. "What is the life story of that man?" Bonnie limited herself to telling about Dwayne's dog, Sparky, who couldn't wag his tail. "So he has to fight all the time," she said. "Wonderful," said Karabekian. He turned to Beatrice. "I'm sure you can use that somewhere." "As a matter of fact, I can," said Beatrice. "That's an enchanting detail." "The more details, the better," said Karabekian. "Thank God for novelists. Thank God there are people willing to write everything down. Otherwise, so much would be forgotten." He begged Bonnie for more true stories. Bonnie was deceived by his enthusiasm and energized by the idea that Beatrice Keedsler honestly needed true stories for her books. "Well," she said, "would you consider Shepherdstown part of Midland City, more or less?" "Of course," said Karabekian, who had never heard of Shepherdstown. "What would Midland City be without Shepherdstown, and what would Shepherdstown be without Midland City?" "Well," said Bonnie, and she thought she had what was maybe a really good story to tell. "My husband is a guard at the Shepherdstown Adult Correctional Institution, and he used to have to keep people who were going to be electrocuted company, back when they used to electrocute people all the time. He'd play cards with them or read parts of the Bible out loud to them or whatever they wanted to do, and he had to keep a white man named Leroy Joyce company." Bonnie's costume gave off a faint, fishy, queer glow as she spoke. This was because her garments were heavily impregnated with fluorescent chemicals. So was the bartender's jacket. So were the African masks on the walls. The chemicals would shine like electric signs when ultraviolet lights in the ceiling were energized. The lights weren't on just now. The bartender turned them on at random times, at his own whim, in order to give the customers a delightful and mystifying surprise. The power for the lights and for everything electrical in Midland City, incidentally, was generated by coal from strip mines in West Virginia, through which Kilgore Trout had passed not many hours before. "Leroy Joyce was so dumb," Bonnie went on. He couldn't play cards. He couldn't understand the Bible. He could hardly talk. He ate his last supper, and then he sat still. He was going to be electrocuted for rape. So my husband sat out in the corridor outside the cell, and he read to himself. He heard Leroy moving around in his cell, but he didn't worry about it. And then Leroy rattled his tin cup on